Howard, let me ask you about this right of privacy. With information now, I mean, most of these companies know our habits, they know what we're doing, they follow us, we have GPS. Does the right of privacy really mean anything these days, or is it an outdated principle?
I think Americans have already, by and large, surrendered the right of privacy, that we are complicit in this, and we have done it because of all the conveniences that we want to enjoy. I mean, you ever have experience where you go online and buy a pair of shoes, and 10 minutes later, every site you go to is serving up shoe ads, even though you're not going to buy any more shoes for another year? That's the small...
Spoken like a man.
Yeah. 1 year is enough for me. It's not just GPS, it's how much Google knows about our searches, it's how much Facebook knows about our preferences so that they can service the algorithms more efficiently. Now, there are ways, if you go through layers of menus, to opt out of this, but I think most people have decided they would rather have the convenience of booking their airline travel online and all of that. And it does worry me. I have the sense that most Americans under 30 do not worry about this at all, that they just see this as the price of living in modern society, that they kind of document everything in their lives online anyway, sometimes without thinking about something they post and how it's going to look to a future employer when they're trying to get a job. So that does worry me, and certainly the security aspects that Ted has talked about so eloquently worry me a great deal. But I think this privacy battle has been lost, and if there are tech companies in the future that want to do more than just exploit us commercially, we have provided a lot of ammunition.
And less than a year ago, I think it was in the fall of last year, Chinese intelligence vacuumed up 21.2 million personnel records. These weren't just random personnel. These were folks from the CIA, folks from the FBI, folks from the Department of Defense, folks from the Department of State. 22.1 million. It's going to take the Chinese 10 years just to sift through that bonanza of intelligence. Now, given that kind of capability among our enemies, the question of the degree to which we want to empower our own intelligence agencies to defend against that kind of thing, that's a very complicated question, more complicated than it's ever been in the past. I mean, the NSA is the most skilled agency that we have in the US government. And if the only way they can defend the United States against our enemies is by penetrating some of my private information. I never thought I'd be saying this. I've been an advocate of privacy all my life, but you know, it's a question of balancing one evil against another.
Yeah. Howard, it's your question. Would you advise your child to enter journalism as a profession?
I have actually faced that question. And I told my oldest daughter that it is not as glamorous as it seems. It's a lot of long hours that you don't necessarily get paid a lot, at least when you set out. And she decided to do it anyway, though she's gone in a slightly different direction from my career. You know, I think about that. We were talking earlier amongst ourselves about newspapers and how we all love the feel of newspapers, grew up reading newspapers, and yet, you know, there aren't many people under 30 who care about having the print edition delivered to their doorstep because they feel like they can get everything online, they can get it through Google, they can get it through Facebook and all of that. So on the one hand, it would be hard for me to, as much as I sort of have ink in my veins, to say, well, gee, being a newspaper reporter, that'd be a great career, because obviously the industry is shrinking. About one third of all newsroom jobs have vanished over the last, I don't know, 8 to 10 years with a real impact, I think, on the kind of watchdog journalism at the local level, especially, where there's no substitute for it. Your local papers here, who's keeping an eye on City Hall and the budgets and the hospitals and the schools and all of that. At the same time, lots of new digital age jobs are being generated, and I do think there is a lot of growth there. So I guess the short answer is I would sound a lot of cautionary notes to whether it's my kids or anybody else's kids about whether that's the future they want. But I think there's a new journalism that is in the process of being created. We're in this transition period now. It's probably comparable to the early days of cable, where we don't know exactly what's going to emerge from all this news on your phone and all that. Will newspapers survive in anything like their current form? But at the same time, it's kind of an exciting time if you are digitally minded to be in the news and information business.
Has social media contributed to the splintering of the two dominant political parties? And I would just add to that, do you think that social media has contributed to the gridlock that we're seeing in Washington, the divisions that are so prevalent these days? Judy?
I think it has, but I don't subscribe to the view that it's mainly responsible for the gridlock. I think it's been coming probably since the 90s, after Bill Clinton was elected. I pretty much date it back to the election of Bill Clinton, when you had his presidency began and you had Newt Gingrich as Speaker of the House and the Contract with America, and you began to see the bifurcating. I mean, there's already a strong disagreement between the parties and raging debates that go back through the history of our country. But there was something that became more personal and more visceral, I think, at that point. And there was almost, I think, a resentment on the part of Republicans, many Republicans, that Bill Clinton was elected. And then in 2000, you had the resentment of Democrats that Republicans took over the White House. And then it got worse. And then it even more so with Obama, for all the reasons that we know. So you've had that, on top of which the redistricting that we've had. I know you've talked about that in your lecture series. We watched the gerrymandering of congressional districts, which contributed to the polarization and gridlock in Washington. Money in politics, another subject I know you've tackled here, that has contributed, I think, greatly. And you put it all into a pot and stir it around, and you throw in cable news and social media and just the technology of today. And we can all go off in our different directions. And as I think I said earlier, we're now not even listening to the other side. We just listen to those people who tell us what we already believe. And social media basically allows us to reinforce that. And I think that's really worrying. I don't subscribe to the idea that somebody's going to come in with a magic wand and say, aha, now we're all united. But I don't see how you begin to bring people together.
Ted, let me ask you, because I've said one of the principal responsibilities of the next president, there are really two responsibilities. One is to break the gridlock in Washington and to govern, because I can't imagine spending another 4 years of paralysis and what that would do to the country. And the other is to provide world leadership. But going to the gridlock question, how does a president break that gridlock?
Well, let me, first of all, this has been a bit of a downer of an evening, so let me...
We've just blown everybody up with the cyber attack.
Well, that's right. I was pointing at myself more than anyone else, but, Winston Churchill, many, many years ago, made the observation that the Americans always end up doing the right thing, but only after they've exhausted every other possibility. We are in the process of exhausting every other possibility. But in answer to your question, Leon, I am hopeful that our president, he or she, will undertake some leadership in this regard. And leadership means not spending your whole life worrying about which medium of communication you're going to use to reach the right people. Leadership means actually doing things, taking some risks, investing whatever capital Mrs. Clinton has, or Donald Trump has, or whoever becomes president, whatever capital they have in those first few months, for God's sake, spend it. I think Americans are beginning to catch on to the notion, and if they aren't, just take a look at what's going on in Great Britain, that we are on the edge of an abyss. that things have gotten very, very bad. That this idea of stovepiping information, of just, you know, as Harry mentioned before, sitting in these little cocoons where we bathe ourselves in echoes of our own prejudices, listening to talk radio or going on whatever social medium it happens to be, I think we will respond to genuine leadership. No matter which medium of communication it reaches us through. But we need leadership. It's been a long time since we've had it. And we need, as a people, to refresh our memories of what America is really about. And I mean, we are not a people that rose to greatness through all these petty animosities that mark our society today. And it is time to remind ourselves that Congress, and here is a man who, throughout his long and distinguished career, has always reached across the aisle. Hell, you've even walked across the aisle, right? People used to respond to that, and I'm confident, Leon, that they will again.
Howard, what can you say? You know, one of my greatest joys in public life was the ability to work across the aisle to get things done. It's no fun to be in Washington if you're just pounding your shoe on the table. The responsibility is to get something done. That's why you elect people to go back to. Twitter is a niche social media tool, and yet candidate tweets make more news today than almost any other media. Why?
Because they're faster. You talked about the Clinton era when the polarization perhaps became worse in Washington, and that was a time when the rapid response unit consisted of sending faxes. They're faster. It's because every journalist I know, I should say most journalists, are on Twitter and are monitoring what they say. And it is because Ted Koppel had a great point when he talked about the illusion of intimacy. You know, a lot of these tweets are written by 22-year-old staff members. Sometimes they get into trouble and they say, oh, the candidate never saw that. It was just this kid who no longer works here. So Twitter probably does have an outsized influence. I mean, as a company that's struggling financially, it doesn't have the huge audience that Facebook does, but it does drive a lot of news and politics because it is so easy for anybody with a public platform to amass a following, whether you are Donald Trump or whether you are Justin Bieber or whether you are an anchor with a television show. And it seems to personalize things. But mostly I think it is the amplification effect. Twitter by itself would have some influence. I can't tell you how many times, because I keep different TVs on different cable networks because part of my job is to know what's going on, where suddenly, you know, Elizabeth Warren has tweeted this back at Donald Trump, and it's easy and it's quick and it's usually kind of like the equivalent of today's 21st century equivalent of a soundbite. So I think those are among the reasons why it now seems to be on the cutting edge, but by next year, it'll be something else.
You think it'll move?
No, I just think that, you know, we keep joking about Snapchat, but for a lot of people who are 18 or 22 or 27, they now think Facebook is kind of old hat, and they are migrating to places like Snapchat, to places like Instagram. And I think Snapchat, there's actually a Business Week article saying it was deliberately designed to appeal to young people by making it too complicated for old folks to figure out how the hell to use. And that made me feel better.
But, you know, Howard, tell people what Snapchat, you know, I'm sure most, this is a very distinguished and yes, well-educated audience, but tell them what Snapchat does. It's an extraordinary piece of equipment?
Well, it began as a way for people, mostly young people, to send to each other messages that within 60 seconds would disappear. Now, use your imagination, if you were a teenager, how that might come in handy. That was the original use of Snapchat, but it has grown. Messaging services are really hot as opposed to just like going to a website. And so it has grown into news organizations now partner with Snapchat, including the New York Times and CNN, I believe. You can follow the news. It uses a lot of images and photos. A lot of the stuff is very transitory. It is even, you know, in my view, more simplified than Twitter. At the same time, it's all about building an audience, and it's all about what is seen as cool. And right now it is seen as very cool, to the point that major media organizations are taking it very seriously, even though some of us have trouble pronouncing it.
But think about what that says about us. That one of the most popular forms of communication now involves communicating either words or an image that will disappear in a matter of seconds. There was a time when we actually thought the whole point of communication was to say something worth remembering. Now we're communicating images and words that are designed to disappear. What does that say about us?
Judy, let me ask you.
I'm going to check it out.
Talk about disappearing.
Judy, let me ask you, Ted commented that the NewsHour does a great job at really kind of doing in-depth presentation of news stories. And it kind of represents what I would call kind of mainstream presentation of the news. And yet, when you go online, it's all about headlines and hits, et cetera, et cetera. Give me your sense of where we're headed. Do you feel that what you're doing in the NewsHour is something that will continue to be there in the future, or is it going to be subsumed by these online tweets that are taking place?
Well, this is self-serving to say this, but I mean, Jim Lehrer and Robin McNeil went on the air in 1975 with the McNeil-Lehrer Report. The show is, Robin retired in 1995, Jim retired in 2011. The show is going stronger than ever. The ratings are up. We have more what we call underwriters, sponsors, backers of the program, because it's public television. We don't sell advertising. So our audience is responding, and I will just anecdotally, I'll tell you, that when we run into people who are people who write in and they tweet to us or email us, or they say, please don't stop doing what you're doing because we don't see anything else like this out there. I'm having a hard time saying this without sounding like I'm just patting me on the back, and I don't want to do that. But I do think the kind of program we do is different enough from what's available in other places that it will continue to have a place in the news media spectrum in this country. The reason, thank you. Gwen and I often say what we do is this is not about us, it's about making sure this program stays strong so that the next anchor and the next anchor and the next team after team after team can carry it on into the future as far as possible.
You look at this stuff seriously. I mean, if you had to look at the next 5 to 10 years, what do you see happening with media and technology? I mean, you know, if we go ahead 10 years into the future, are newspapers fading out? Are shows like this gonna fade out? Are we all gonna be online with our Apple? What do you see happening?
If I knew the answer to that, I would know which stocks to buy. And I'll answer your question in a moment, Leon, but just for the record, I went to Snapchat on the Discover tab. I see People Magazine, ESPN, Comedy Central, BuzzFeed, CNN, Mashable, and Cosmopolitan, and Vice. So it's a real eclectic connection of organizations. Everybody in my business is trying to figure that out as a matter of survival. So for example, our newspaper is going to become a niche product because as the population ages, people who feel the need to have something dropped in their doorstep will diminish. Will they move completely online? I think online will be the dominant form of news delivery. Everybody in the television business knows that the audience is getting older, that a lot of people are cutting the cord, that they don't feel the need to have a cable news subscription that is bundled so you're paying for the sports channels whether you watch them or not, even if you only want to watch MSNBC or Fox or the local channels or PBS, which is indispensable. So I feel that a lot of the trends that are moving us toward more individualized news of people coming up with their own menu. There's an application that I call Flipboard, where you can basically design your own magazine. It can include your Twitter feed, but it can also include any number of organizations you like, whether you are interested in tennis, or whether you're interested in politics, or whether you're interested in lots of subjects in between. The question I have is, will any of these new forms be able to generate enough revenue, because digital ads don't pay that much right now, we're all kind of hanging on in that space, to support newsrooms that, as in the heyday of the networks and the newspapers before they lost a lot of their staff, were able to do investigative reporting, enterprise reporting, holding politicians accountable, as well as cover the local sports teams and the local schools and all of that. And that is an open question, and my great, I tend to be optimistic. I think there's a lot of smart people coming up in the ranks who will figure this out, but my great fear is that if people just go for what is easy and quick and disappearing messages, that those newsrooms will hollow out and we will lose something that will be very hard to get back, and that is the journalistic muscle to do what news organizations have always done.
What do you think?
May I do a quick poll here? How many of you here have seen or heard of a program called Last Week Tonight with John Oliver? Oh, good. That's not bad. I'd say that's about a third. It is an absolutely brilliant program. John Oliver is a British comedian. Speed up?
Yes.
Oh.
Because we're down to 1 minute.
It's a damn good program. Watch it.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the end of the program. And it's been, as always, a great and fascinating discussion, with particularly with the quality of speakers that we've had here. But I do really want all of you to focus on this issue of the kind of technology and media that we're dealing with, because I truly believe that whoever is elected the next president of the United States, that in many ways the success or failure of that president will really be determined by how effectively that person is able to communicate with the American people and to unify this country rather than dividing it. That hopefully will be our future and the future that our children need in order to have a better life. Thank you very much for attending tonight.